Metaphysics or physics is the much needed and crucial voice of reason in the philosophy of science, rarely found anywhere else in the world today. We are equipped with the fundamental principles of a rational philosophy that gives us the edge, may make us misfits in the mainstream sciences, but also attracts rational minds to our community. With this show, we are fighting for a more rational world, mostly by looking through the lens of the philosophy of science. We raise awareness of issues within the philosophy of science and present alternative and rational approaches. We are your hosts and guides through the hallowed halls of the philosophy of science. Dwayne Davies, my husband, is the founder, primary content creator, and voice for Metaphysics of Physics. I am Ashna, and I help out however I can. You can find out more about us on the About page of the website. You can also find all the episodes, transcripts, subscription options, and more on the website at metaphysicsofphysics.com.
Hello. Welcome to episode 25 of the Metaphysics of Physics podcast. I am Dwayne Davies, your occasional host. Today, we are going to interview Warren Fay, the author of the best-selling books Fragment and Pandemonium. Some of you may not know what these are. Well, Warren is going to tell us all about them in a little bit. They are science thrillers, something along the lines of Jurassic Park. You can probably gather by the fact that I am interviewing him about these books, that I have read them, and that I probably enjoy them. Yes, I have read them, and yes, I do enjoy them. Fragment and the sequel are amazingly interesting books with some extremely compelling biological theories. There are some truly terrifying nightmare creatures in both of them. They make the dinosaurs and monsters in other books seem tame. Dragons? T-Rexes? The critters in these books, such as the spiders, are much, much deadlier and scarier. I also quite like the main cast of characters, but I cannot talk much about that without some spoilers. But two of them are biologists, and they may have some fascinating biological ideas, new and old. Highly recommended. But more than that, and as entertaining as the scary monsters are, you might also learn something reading these books. Now we have that out of the way, let's get back into things. Thank you for being here, Warren. Give us a brief introduction to Fragment and Pandemonium. Later questions will focus more on the science and the like. So maybe for now, focus more on the theme and plot.
Perfect. All right. Well, Fragment and Pandemonium are science thrillers, somewhat in the vein of Michael Crichton books, which happen to be my favorite kind of thriller. I like to read a thriller and get something out of it, get some new information, learn something. So that was the kind of book I decided I wanted to write. And since I was a kid, I've been studying evolution ever since I dug a fossil out of the hills behind my grandparents' home when I was 8. And ever since then, I've been fascinated by evolution. So I decided to, you know, mine that avenue for a thriller, since I hadn't really seen one ever deal with the concept of a completely separate evolution that was isolated and went off in a completely different direction, resulting in an entire ecosystem of almost alien creatures. And if you went back far enough, I figured you could actually make a very compelling world. And so Fragment and Pandemonium are just that. Fragment is the story of a fragment of an ancient supercontinent that had been isolated for 550 million years and was lost in the middle of the South Pacific Ocean, right in the middle of the Roaring Forties, which is a current that ships try to avoid in their shipping routes. And I decided to put a reality TV show that's circumnavigating the world in the path of this island. And what they discover, of course, is an alien world of such it's such a dangerous world that they're almost all slaughtered on live television as they land. And this calls attention to the United States government, and the Navy isolates the island and sends in a team of scientists to find out what in the world is going on. And what they discover is a world that if any of the species from it were to escape and get to the rest of the world, it would be only a matter of time before they knocked out the legs from every single ecosystem on planet Earth. So that's the premise of Fragment. Pandemonium is the sequel, which has some of the survivors moving on to yet another ecosystem that has been isolated in a giant cave system under the Ural Mountains in a fictitious country. And within that cave system, the former Soviet Union has built a gigantic city from which to escape any possible pandemonium from any kind of worldwide nuclear conflagration. So then we discover an entirely different universe of creatures, an ecosystem that descended instead of from the Cambrian era, like Fragment, descended from the Devonian, in which a molluscan ecosystem is chiefly mollusks instead of arthropods, like the Cambrian era descendants. And so we have an entire, once again, another menu of crazy, monstrous animals to deal with. So those are the two science-heavy books, and they incorporate a lot of different new theories and required a lot of interesting research.
That fossil you dug up when you were 8, did you ever find out what it was?
I did, in fact. It was just one leaf from a fern. And my uncle was a geophysicist, and he identified it for me. He had collected a lot of trilobites from a nearby quarry, and those really fired my imagination. And so many years later, I would write Fragment about a world that had descended from that era, the era of trilobites, and what if they had gone off on their own, separate from everything else on planet Earth, what would they look like 500 million years later?
Okay. Now we can talk about some of the science ideas in the book. Tell us about some of those.
Well, since I've been studying evolution since I was a kid, I have been sort of like an armchair biologist of, you know, endlessly fascinated by the process of evolution. And three theories along the way occurred to me while I was studying various different aspects of evolution. And there are two such theories presented in Fragment, which are original theories, and which have actually, one of the which has actually listed some interest from some actual geneticists who are studying lifespan. And that particular theory, the theory of lifespan and what actually dictates the lifespan of species, all species on Earth, derived basically from looking at barnacles. Barnacles are something that fascinated Darwin to no end, and they are amazing creatures. People don't seem to really understand that they're crustaceans, like crabs or lobsters, and they're obviously the weirdest crustacean on Earth. The fact that they only live about 2 years versus mussels that live right next to them, which have almost an unlimited lifespan, they can live up to 70 years. So I was thinking, why in the world would these two species have such a vastly different lifespan? As I studied it, I realized that there was a difference between the way they procreate. Of course, mussels procreate by this huge bloom of sex cells that they all release all at the same time, trillions of sex cells that drift in a cloud and end up creating the next generation. And barnacles, however, have the largest sexual member in proportion to body size of any animal on Earth. They have to procreate by literally reaching it over to the next neighbor next to it in order to inseminate that neighbor. And then that's how they create the next generation. So that was a clue. And the fact that they reach sexual maturity in 1 year and die by the time their offspring reach sexual maturity was a giant clue. And so, of course, all species on Earth become unable to procreate if they mate with their offspring. And that there's all kinds of different reasons and biological barriers that stop that from happening. And if they didn't stop that from happening, then that species would die out in very short order. Even plants that procreate with their own offspring will become unable to procreate in only two or three generations. So as I started to check this theory out by looking at animals and plants with lifespans, I found that the theory held true with absolutely every species across the board. Any animal that was that could, you know, theoretically cross breed with their own offspring had a fixed lifespan at twice the age of sexual maturity, so that they could not compete with the next generation and mate with their own offspring. And this is true from everything from redwoods and sequoias to whales to any species that you can name. And certain species get around it without lifespan because they don't need it. For instance, sequoias mate the same way that mussels do, or the coral reefs do, with giant clouds of sex cells that are all released at once, and the chances of them actually, you know, breeding with their own offspring are so slim that they're infinitesimal, they're vanishingly small. However, if you look at like whales also congregate in giant groups, so there's no way, you know, they don't mate for life or anything. They randomly mix, and these mixers, as they meet several times a year, and that makes it impossible for them. So certain bowhead whales have been discovered have lived about 250 years, for instance, and sequoias live 2,000-3,000 years, virtually unlimited lifespans. However, then you look at animals that live in small groups, rabbits, for instance, they reach sexual maturity in a year and they die at 2 years because they're in a small group right, you know, next to their own offspring, and they have to just die off so that there's no chance. So this is just an amazing, like, for instance, turkeys, which are, you know, these virtually flightless, very stupid birds that kind of move around in the same area, die in about 2 years. After 1 year, they reach sexual maturity. 2 years later, they die. Ostriches that mate for life don't have any, there's no risk of them ever mating with their own offspring because they mate for life, and they can live 60, 70, 80 years. So the theory was just absolutely held true all the way through. So I decided to include that as one of the characters' own theories, since the two protagonist scientists in the book believe that you should always think outside the box when you're trying to analyze what's going on in any particular biological system. And so I gave these theories to those scientists in the book. And the second one is about life, about how the origin of sex, and that certain cells were carnivores. Single-celled animals used to attack other single-celled animals, and they ended up mingling their DNA, and it became a profitable solution to the predator-prey relationship, and that males would end up becoming inheriting genes from the females, and the females likewise from the males, and that would give them an evolution in tandem through as they became partners instead of enemies. That's one of the theories. And in Pandemonium, there's the theory of evolution, of human evolution. And, you know, often people would say, how is it possible for human beings to have evolved so rapidly and in such a direction that conforms so perfectly to the needs of a highly sentient creature? For instance, developing vocal cords and the dexterity of our mouths and tongues and the ability to make so many different sounds in vocalization, or opposable thumbs that are so perfect for making tools. And how did all this, you know, dovetail so perfectly with the needs of an intellectual animal? And so that theory is that we have, in a sense, invented ourselves. The first time an ancestor of human beings decided to use language, it set a new stage for success. And any one of the descendants of those animals that had developed that, the idea of language culturally, would then select for all those within that group that could utilize that idea most successfully, and therefore pass along their genes to the next generation, whereas those who are less able to would have less of a chance to pass their genes on to the next generation. And so every idea that humans came up with set the stage for a new selection process from that point forward, and therefore we evolved to express our ideas. And in that way, in that sense, we invented ourselves and sped up our evolution in a particular direction. So those are the theories that are presented in the book as fire-breathing chats, which are delivered by the main protagonists of the books. It's a long-winded explanation, but you know, they're scientific theories, so.
All right, in one of the fire-breathing chats, Nell mentions how Dawkins' meme theory is something of a follow-up to the theory of self-directed human evolution, which you were just talking about. Would you care to elaborate?
Yeah, well, I think that it's, you know, I just kind of sort of traced the basic outline of the theory, and it's a way to explain further how a particular creature in the books, and this is a kind of a spoiler alert, in Fragment, they come across a, you know, an anthropod, or at least a mammal-like anthropod that has evolved over half a billion years on the island, and it is sentient. And so to explain how that kind of deviation could occur within arthropods and then accelerate into creating a creature that was equally comfortable with the intellectual needs of a sentient being, you know, in a short period, relatively short period of time, and this theory was very useful to the scenario that's being presented in both books, and to explain how that other sentient animal evolved on planet Earth, and how, and it as well explained how we did. And so that was you know, the theory that ideas or memes translate into genes, that our memes are selected for, and they select our genes moving forward, so that they have a very close corollary and very close interaction in evolution. It's true with other animals too. For instance, that they're driven out of a habitat and they now have a different items of food will start to evolve if their behavior changes to actually utilize those other sources of food. They will start to evolve to capture that food in a more efficient manner. So ideas and behavior dictate evolution. And in that sense, we sort of direct our own evolution, and human beings have directed their own evolution.
In that same section, you mentioned the thing that distinguishes humans and hendropods from the rest of the animal kingdom. Would you care to elaborate more on what this thing is? You kind of touched on it.
I'll just sum it up in the sense that these two species are the only species that actually direct their own evolution by first coming up with an idea that they may not be completely capable of executing. For instance, the first time someone picked up a rock and said, you know, look, we can make a tool, we can make a sharp edge if we smack these together. That creature may not have had very good opposable thumbs. He did have the idea, however, to make this. And from that point forward, all of the other members of his group, if they had better thumbs, would be more proficient at using that idea, and they would therefore be more successful mating and passing along their genes to the next generation. So the idea would end up selecting the next generation and the next generation and the next generation, and each one would have a better facility at using tools with hand-to-eye coordination, opposable thumbs, etc., and even brain centers that were needed for that activity would be selected for moving forward. So that we're kind of the only creature, and the same with the hendros, that created themselves with their own ideas, and that's the basic idea. Yeah, kind of it adds a corollary to Dawkins' theory.
Okay, you have touched on this one too. What inspired you to write Fragment and Pandemonium? What were some of your influences?
Well, for Fragment, actually, there was one specific thing that gave me the idea for Fragment, and that was I was studying the discovery in Romania of a cave called the Movil Caves, and it was isolated for 5 million years, no contact with the surface whatsoever, And when researchers went down into this cave, which was about like the size of, say, a cathedral, and was covered with a lake that was covered with a thick mat of microbes, and had been completely cut off from sunlight. And yet in this cave existed 33 species that didn't exist anywhere else on the planet. And this was only after 5 million years of isolation. And so that idea occurred to me that, you know, there are many lost world novels and, you know, adventure stories, where usually you have the world frozen in time, right? That's the original Arthur Conan Doyle lost world scenario, where because these creatures have been isolated, they've been frozen in time. And now there's dinosaurs and, you know, all kinds of primitive prehistoric creatures. That's not really the way evolution works, though. When things are isolated, they start drifting genetically away from where their starting point and the point when they were isolated. So the idea that you could create a lost world scenario for an adventure story based on long-term isolation that would create almost an alien world right here on planet Earth immediately formed in my mind, and that's when I started work on it. So that was the original inspiration.
Yeah, I thought that was weird. That whole frozen time thing. I mean, I don't know why, you know, anyone who understands evolution would think that. But Conan Doyle had all kinds of weird ideas, I guess.
Yeah, and I think at the time that, you know, it was rather, you know, the idea of evolution was hadn't completely sunk in. And so people were finding, you know, they were looking for living fossils, basically, and they're looking for throwbacks that were clues to evolution, but they weren't really thinking about the fact that isolation would actually create a genetic drift into a different direction. And that's, you know, we're much more sophisticated now than they were then.
Yeah. This was back when they still believed Richard Owen's idea of dinosaurs being slow swamp-dwelling critters.
There were a lot of mistaken ideas at that time. It was also new. But now it was time for an update on that, you know, that idea. And so I decided to go all the way back to the Cambrian explosion and say, wow, look at the species from this time, and imagine if they had just continued in an unbroken line from that point, isolated from all the rest of the world, that had gone through so many environmental upheavals that they kept getting thinned out by extinction events. But this particular fragment of a supercontinent that continued to dwindle down to the almost like a 2 mile wide radius had been an unbroken part of the world where that evolutionary progress continued and was never interrupted. So that's the basis of how Henders Island came to exist.
Tell us about any real world islands or caves where some unusual wildlife has been found.
Oh yeah. Oh well, there's terrific ones. Actually, about a couple of months after Fragment came out, a team of scientists from the Smithsonian Institute visited Papua New Guinea, and they explored the Basavi Crater, which is almost the same exact size of Henders Island. And at the bottom of this volcanic crater, which had been, the life inside this crater had been isolated for millions of years. And they found kangaroos that live in trees and frogs with fangs and rats the size of dogs. Just an entirely different ecosystem was dwelling at the bottom of this crater, and it was absolutely stunning to them. They explained it. This is like as if there was an island in the middle of nowhere, isolated for millions of years, and all everything inside it had drifted in its own direction. So that happened 2 months after Fragment came out, and I was pretty amazed by that. But obviously, Australia, New Zealand, Madagascar, the Seychelles. These are all places that are known for their distinct species, and you know, very interesting throwbacks. And you know, of course, on Australia we have everything proceeded from marsupials, and there were the age of mammals never arrived there. So those are great obvious examples, but I think my favorite probably is Socotra Island, where the tree species on that island, and there's almost everything on the island looks like it came from an alien planet. The tree species were a big inspiration for the tree, quote unquote, species that are on the island of Henders. And they're caves too. I mean, for instance, there was a cave discovered in the Sequoia National Park where all of, again, cave species almost always have completely distinct species that are nowhere else to be found. And this cave system was no different. But some of the species inside the cave evolved to live in only one room of the cave. So that's how specialized they had these creatures had become, just because they were isolated inside this cave.
Okay. What are some of the weirdest real-life species, extinct or extant? Which ones might you like to talk about now? I guess you've covered some of them, but there are, of course, lots of others you have not covered.
Yeah, certainly. Of course, stomatopods or mantis shrimp feature in the book quite a bit. Those are some of the most extraordinary creatures. If there was probably ever going to be a creature that replaced us on planet Earth, I like to think the mantis shrimp would be that creature. You know, we have 3 color receptors. Mantis shrimp have 12. So they see millions of colors we can't see. They have a punch with their some of their forelegs, which can shatter bulletproof glass. They have incredible sight acuity. Their eyes have 3 different pupils in each eye, so they see more than stereophonic, vision with each eye. And so that enables them to track fast-moving prey and strike it as it's moving past much more efficiently than any other animal on Earth. And they have a nervous system which is extremely advanced. So they're amazing. If you know, octopus have arguably 9 brains, 8 for each of their arms. One of my favorite animals are tree hoppers. And just because they're the most insane shapes and sizes and colors, tiny little insects which jump around on plants and trees, which are almost everywhere in every backyard, but there's literally tens of thousands of species all around the world, mostly overlooked because of their size, but they are incredible. There's an infinite number, as you can see on my website. I'm always posting about a new species on my Facebook page every day, just to show the vast variety of amazing creatures that are out there, some of which I did not find out about until after designing the creatures on Henders Island and in Pandemonium, because an entire fictitious ecosystem is in both books. And designed a creature. Mostly I was trying to come up with creatures that locomoted in a completely alien way. And some of the creatures, like Henders rats and spigers, locomote with a tail that springs and lunges them forward through the trees. And I thought, okay, that's going to be something completely new. Turns out springtails have been around forever and they do exactly the same thing. So also of course, the idea of the discants, which roll, you know, that's the way they locomote. I thought I'd never find anything like that, but there are spiders that I found out after the book came out that do in fact turn on their sides and roll down sand dunes in the Sahara Desert. So almost anything you can come up with that is at least physically possible has been, tried out by evolution. And that's one of the most staggering things about the planet. There's so much that we think we can't imagine. And even if we could, it's already it's already happened.
It's hard to think of something evolution hasn't already tried.
Indeed.
Okay, why do you think that knowledge of evolution, biology, anthropology, etc. are important? And why do you think so many people want to pretend that it isn't?
Well, I think that, I think one of the reasons that people intuitively look at human beings and say, this can't be the process of evolution, right? It must be God, right, that created this, because we are so perfectly adapted to the life of an intellectual creature that it seems like that the mind of an intellectual creature created us. And my argument is, yes, that's correct. But we are that creature that created ourselves. And it's important to understand that, because there tends to be this conflict between evolution and creationism that says something as specifically evolved to be human could not have just come about accidentally through a giant chain of accidents. And I would say that's correct. It is not in conflict with the scientific theory of evolution, however, if we understand that our ideas have directed specifically our own evolution. And so it reconciles that problem that otherwise people would say, oh, well, it's got to be a divine spark. Well, yes, it was, in a sense. It was, but it was ourselves that created that divine spark and that directed the way we would evolve moving forward. So we are different from all other animals in the world in that way. And that's why we seem to stand so far apart from other animals. And that's a very important thing to understand, rather than have this endless irreconcilable conflict between religion and science.
There is this other idea that the moment we developed opposable thumbs, that we started to direct our own evolution. That is not quite what you are proposing, but kind of similar.
It's kind of similar. I would say that it's a little bit the cart before the horse, though, in the sense that I think that maybe the first person who came up with an idea that required opposable thumbs was probably pretty clumsy at trying to put that idea into effect. But as soon as that idea took hold, any other member of the group who had a better, slightly better arrangement of thumbs and of thumbs to hand would obviously be instantly much more successful and would pass on their genes more successfully to the next generation. So the idea would come first. Like, for instance, first somebody came up with the idea of, wait, we can use a sound to signify something out there. And maybe it was just a grunt and that meant mastodon. And as soon as that idea of using language to name things in the world took flight, then, of course, people who could make more distinguishable sounds became very successful within that group and in that culture. And they would be more likely to pass on their genes, and their pursuant generations would get better and better at utilizing the idea of speech. So the idea has to come first and set the stage for success. And then everything that implements that idea more successfully has more children and therefore passes along their genes more successfully. So that's the order of things, I believe.
We're not the only hominid species to have opposable thumbs. The Neanderthals had them, but they are not around anymore.
That's right. They're not. And at one time, there were at least like five or six different kinds of human, you might say, on planet Earth. The Neanderthals, the Denisovans, the Homo erectus, the hobbits, as they're called, on the island of Flores, and Homo sapiens all coexisted at one time on planet Earth. So it was the most successful species of those, us, that ended up getting through the bottleneck and surviving today.
Let's talk about Thatcher Redmond for a moment. He is quite the horrific character. Now, some people might not get this, but there are people like this, at least in terms of his ideology. Would you like to comment on this? I get the feeling that this guy might be loosely based on some real people.
Yes, Thatcher Redmond, a very terrible villain who you'd be surprised to know how many people consider him to be a hero. I get a lot of people writing to me saying, all right, Thatcher, go Thatcher. That's was a big surprise to me. But yes, there are those who feel that human beings are a menace to the world, And one of the things that I wanted to do with these books, and I think that when Jurassic Park came out, a whole generation of kids were suddenly stimulated and inspired to go into science. And there was probably a huge crop of paleontologists that came about because of Jurassic Park. And they credit it to, you know, why they chose that path in life. And a generation later, I wanted to do the same thing. I thought that there were too many books that were and movies and everything else that were constantly coming out and saying mankind is the worst blight on the planet ever. It's terrible. We're destroying everything. And that's a pretty depressing thing to tell children and to constantly tell them, and with no abatement, no relief from that constant message. I think it's led to a lot of people being a lot of that the generation in between Jurassic Park and Fragment, you know, being very anti-human being. Anti themselves, in a sense, which is a real pity. And I wanted children to look at science and look at themselves as a potentially heroic species, and that science is a wonderful, beneficial thing to get into. And therefore, I wanted to show human beings not being the villain. And in fact, on the island, on Henders Island, the natural environment is filled with beasties that would eat you in a second. And of course, Thatcher Redmond thinks this is great because maybe they'll get off the island and wipe out the human race and everything else on the planet. And then there won't be any intelligent species anymore to screw everything up. But what they find, of course, the big surprise on the island is a sentient creature, which turns out to be the least dangerous potentially on the island. And there's a big dilemma. Do we save this creature and wipe out everything else so that it doesn't, you know, destroy the rest of the planet? And of course, Thatcher Redmond is saying this is the last creature we should take off this island because it's intelligent and it's just as big a menace as we are. And so it creates this moral dilemma for the characters to resolve in the book.
I wondered how long it would take for someone to mention Jurassic Park. By the way, I think your books are a lot scarier than Jurassic Park.
A lot of people tell me that. Yeah, well, it was meant to be. But of course, I couldn't possibly have written the book without the great Michael Crichton, you know, the blazing the trail. There's an interesting little story, kind of a bittersweet story. When I first submitted the novel for two publishing houses, the HarperCollins in England, there was a big bidding war at the London Book Fair, and HarperCollins won the war. And I went to London to meet my editors, and they said, how did you do it? We get 2,500 wannabe Michael Crichton novels every single year, and all of them are terrible. And how did you do this? And I said, I gave, you know, credit where it's due. Crichton was a great example. And then a woman came up to me at this party and said, you know, she had tears in her eyes. She said, we're so, you know, privileged to publish your novel. And thank you very much for going with HarperCollins. And, oh, well, that's my honor. Thank you. And she left. And then they told me that's Michael Crichton's editor right there. Then after the party, some people rushed up to us and said, we have terrible news. Michael Crichton just died. And that's why his editor had tears in her eyes. So it was a real shock. And I had hoped to meet him, really. And that was as close as I came. So
how many times did you read Jurassic Park when you were younger? I was pretty dinosaur crazy or something when I was a kid. I read that book like 11 times or something, insane like that.
Well, I read very slowly and I read a book once and I just absorb it completely. So that's because I'm really looking at sentence structure, you know, the overall story structure, all those things when I'm reading. So, you know, I rarely revisit books. I just sort of like mimeograph them in my mind, have them there at my disposal in mentally.
Okay. And what are some of your favorite books in these fields?
Yeah, well, I think one of the great pleasures that I've had through the years is watching David Attenborough's documentaries and reading his books. I read Life on Earth, for instance, and some of his other books, and then watched. I actually got a video DVD player that plays United Kingdom region DVDs just so I could watch the unabridged version of Life on Earth, which is about 10 times larger than the one that was available in the United States. And it goes through the entire evolution of life using living examples that still represent each stage of life's evolution. So those are great. Carl Sagan's books are great popularizers of science that are great for people who are just starting to look into these things. Obviously, there's lots of textbooks, but they're very dry. I did study biology in college, and those were very useful, but I wouldn't be able to name the author or the titles off the top of my head. They're just very dry text-type books. But those are terrific. I also am very fascinated by the Ediacara, which were a very mysterious group of animals that existed before the Cambrian explosion. And there are theories that they all died off completely and were replaced by the next generation of animals. And there is a book called The Garden of Ediacara by Mark McMenamin, which was very fascinating. I really enjoyed that. And so, you know, those are great starting points. And Crichton, of course, as well. You can learn a lot from Crichton's books. So those and documentaries and dinosaur books are always fun. So yeah, a lot of those.
I have been reading a lot of Donald Passero myself lately. Have you read any of his books?
No, but I loved the books by Stephen Jay Gould, Wonderful Life, The Burgess Shale and the Nature of History is a terrific book. The Origin of Species is a terrific book. So, but Stephen Jay Gould is a really exciting writer, and it's really fun to look at some of his theories. I can read a couple quotes to you from Stephen Jay Gould's Wonderful Life that you can see some inspiration for Fragment in, if you'd like.
Oh, yes, please.
Okay, here's one. Alter any event ever so slightly and without apparent importance at the time, and evolution cascades into a radically different channel. That's from Wonderful Life, The Burgess Shale, and The Nature of History by Stephen Jay Gould. Here's another. Some 15 to 20 Burgess species cannot be allied with any known group and should probably be classified as separate phyla. Magnify some of them beyond the few centimeters of their actual size, and you're on the set of a science fiction film. Here's another. I'll give you one more. If Ediacara survivors had been able to evolve internal complexity later on, then the pathways from this radically different starting point would have produced a world worthy of science fiction at its best. That's another quote from that same book. So yes, those were inspirational.
I don't think I've read that one yet. Fragment has a whole bunch of crazy and fantastic arthropods, and Pandemonium has a lot of weird mollusks. Did you choose these phyla because they are so diverse and amazing, or because they are personal favorites of yours, or what? I guess a bit of both, really.
Yeah, oh, absolutely both. And also because they both emerged long enough ago for them to have had plenty of time to evolve in a lot of even weirder directions. If something that was too recent would be, difficult to account for, imaginative evolutionary adaptations. So to go all the way back to when cephalopods first appeared, and then sort of had an entire dynasty where they took over the world, just like arthropods had before them in the Cambrian era. And those are long enough times away, like 550 million years for arthropods. And for cephalopods, even though they were around during the Cambrian, they didn't really take off until the age of ammonites, that filled the seas with these giant nautilus-like shells, and created all kinds of different kinds of species had blossomed during that age. And that was about 300 million years ago. So that was enough time for them to adapt to these isolated ecosystems on, for instance, Henders Island or in Pandemonium, the cave system under the Ural Mountains. So and of course, yeah, there's enough variation of those species to have all kinds of stuff to choose from for creating amazing animals.
What are some of the most controversial biological ideas which you were interested in?
of course, genetics is the whole future frontier that is the most interesting, unquestionably. But the thing I'm most interested in is the fairly new emerging science regarding epigenetics, which really challenges a lot of our concepts of evolution. And epigenetics is, you know, there's a big a debate historically in biology between the Lamarckians and the Darwinians. And Lamarck believed, for instance, that the reason that giraffes developed long necks was because they kept reaching up higher into the trees to get leaves to eat. And because they kept straining their necks upward, their children inherited longer necks. That was the Lamarckian theory before Darwin came along and said, no, it's natural selection, and had a completely different theory of how things evolved. So that was the argument for so long. And now epigenetics comes along, and that is the idea that genes are modified by certain behaviors during a person's life, which almost starts moving back towards a Lamarckian idea, and that genetics can be affected by behavior, and those genetics can then be passed on to the next generation. That's a fascinating new frontier. So that, I would say, is most fascinating. And I think that the other most mysterious group of life that is still quite mysterious would be the fungi. Some of the very, very oldest species or group of animals to appear on planet Earth. They now believe that the first fungi existed, you know, far past 1 billion years ago, which is certainly before a lot of almost every other kind of life. So I think that's a frontier that I would love to explore in a future book.
Speaking of which, tell us about your next book. When can we read it? And when you finish it, where can we get it?
Well, the next book and the final book in the Fragment trilogy will be called Symbiont, and it will explore the world of fungi. It'll be set in the Pacific Northwest in a deep old growth forest. And I really don't want to say too much about it, but it will include some of our favorite characters from the series. And it will probably be finished within a year. And after that, it will be available wherever books are sold. So,
what are some of your favorite books and authors? I think we've pretty much covered this one.
Yeah, sure. Well, I don't read a lot of contemporary fiction. I mostly read classics and nonfiction. But obviously, Crichton, Conan Doyle. I love all the Sherlock Holmes stories. I really do. Those are wonderful. Victor Hugo, Martin Amis is an amazing author. Mark Twain, fantastic. I love stylists like Flaubert and Bukowski and Fonte and Hemingway. Agatha Christie's really great, really fun. Stephen King, some of it, fantastic. I really love. Prince of Tides is an amazing book by Pat Conroy. Tolkien and Asimov and Bradbury, Cornell, Philip K. Dick, Murtry, Raymond Chandler, James M. Cain. Frankenstein's an amazing book. Homer and Orwell. Yeah. Maybe, Ursula K. Le Guin. A lot of great writers, great stylists with very distinct voices.
Okay. And what are some of your biggest literary influences? Oops, you've kind of answered this one too, to some extent.
Well, yeah, I mean, probably all the books that you read add to the stew of your own style and your own influences. And I would say all of those certainly have added something along the way. And then from that, you develop your own style. So yeah, all those books would have been good soil from which to grow a distinct voice of your own, you know.
Okay, yeah. What kind of research did you do for your books?
Oh, lots and lots and lots of research. That, as soon as I knew I was going to write this book in a modern setting, it was obviously important to get the state-of-the-art science right. And it's a big challenge because you're developing an entire ecosystem, you know, not from whole cloth, but one that doesn't exist. And so I immediately started plunging into research in books and on the internet. And the internet has an amazing amount of resources that if you're digging into highly specialized science, you can find papers on any particular kind of question you might have. And I just reached out to experts in the field. For instance, I knew that I needed for Henders Island, I needed to have some reason that these species had never managed to migrate off of the island in 500 million years. And one of the reasons I came to was that the oceans have been getting more and more salty over that period of time. And so salt would have been a barrier for these creatures to get off the island. And so I reached out to a specialist in the study of osmoregulation in crustaceans, which is how do crustaceans manage the changes in salinity in water. And certain species live at a river delta, and so they have to go back and forth, and they have to be able to process a sudden increase in salinity in the water. And so that's what I wanted to study, and I found one of the leading experts in that field, and I wrote him a letter, and I said, look, I'm writing a novel, and I need to know some answers about osmoregulation in crustaceans. And he wrote back and said, what on earth kind of novel could you possibly be writing that you need some information about that? And I explained the novel to him, and he said, oh, count me in. I'm all over it. So he summered in Woods Hole at the Marine Biology Lab there. And I went out, visited him, and visited the laboratories where they extract horseshoe blood, and toured the laboratories there. And it was just a great experience. It was I was able to fill in a lot of detail for the book from that kind of personal on-site touring of places like that, and continued to ask any kind of question I had about certain species. I would just reach out to experts and find out, get some of their off the top of their head answers, and then further pursue that with more research. So yeah, luckily I had been also researching all my life biology. It was just a real favorite pastime. So yeah, there was a ton of research that went into it. And then I also ran it past these experts, so that to see, their own objections and adjust things accordingly. So it would sound and be something that would pass muster and would be enjoyable for actual scientists to read the book. And indeed, that's how it's turned out. The book is used to teach biology in Spain and various different courses that American colleges use it. So it's the amount of research has been appreciated in the scientific community, even though, of course, it's obviously a book that's fun and requires a lot of suspension of disbelief. But it's credible enough for them to take the roller coaster ride and have fun.
On your blog, we can see this quote: since Fragment came out, a number of other isolated ecosystems have been discovered, each one astonishing scientists with the variety of the unprecedented plants and animals. Would you like to tell us about some of these amazing discoveries?
There are some other really fun ones to investigate. Of course, the Movil Cave in Romania was a big inspiration for Fragment, and would end up being an even bigger inspiration for Pandemonium. The Basavi Crater of Papua New Guinea came out after Fragment, but is almost like the same story. The deep ecosystems around Antarctica have yielded hundreds of new species. The subterranean lake in Antarctica, Lake Vostok, it was a much anticipated discovery as people finally drilled through the ice and got to see the species that had been isolated in that lake for a very great period of time. Lake Baikal, near the Ural Mountains, is the largest body of fresh water on Earth, and it has an amazingly diverse ecosystem of species that you won't find anywhere else, and even freshwater coral, just an amazing place. And then the sealed caves like that in Sequoia National Park, which have you know, species that are unique to only one room in the cave, things like that. So all islands that have been isolated for a long period of time have very specialized, unique species like the Seychelles or Papua New Guinea or New Zealand and Australia, of course, Madagascar. Even Hawaii, it's only been isolated for, only existed for 5 million years, but there are a whole plethora of bird species that evolved there, nowhere else, and plant species. So yes, there's many, 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 and mostly you would find they're isolated systems that are going to yield the most unique ecosystems, and they would be lakes, underground caves, islands, things like that. That's where you'll find them.
Okay, you have a Patreon account where our listeners can go to support your work. Time to plug your Patreon.
Yes, yes, very, very much appreciated. Yes, it's publishing doesn't always help you financially, kids. Sometimes you end up worse off having published a book than you were before. But so yes, it does help me keep writing to contribute a bit to my Patreon account, which is Warren Fay at Patreon. And I have a PayPal account, and generous fans can help me keep body and soul together by visiting and contributing, throwing a few pence into the hat, as it were. And they're located at my website, which is warrenfay.com. And yeah, very good. Thank you for asking.
Right. That's great. Go check all that out and maybe make a contribution. And now a couple of reader questions. First, where do you get the ideas for these amazing creatures in your books?
Yeah, well, you know, I started with the starting point of saying, okay, what I'm going to do is try to come up with the most alien kind of behaviors, especially through locomotion, that from anything else that you've ever seen. So as soon as you look at these creatures, you're like, oh my God, this is not something that we've ever encountered before. And so that way I just looked and said, it's not going to run like a dinosaur. It's not going to act like a mammal. It's not going to act like mollusks that we know of. It's going to have a completely new and different combination of behaviors. And so starting from just like trying to go at right angles to everything that existed already, and then say, okay, how can we evolve to get to that, you know, this far out thing that we've never seen before, and build and fill in the dots between what we do know and this crazy thing that we've never imagined. So that was a good way to design them, just to design them at right angles to everything we already know. That's essentially what I did, and of course make them real scary.
For sure. All right, next question. Where are you keeping Hinda?
Ah, yes. Well, that's somewhat of a secret. Of course, he loves the island of Kauai, so he is somewhere on that island. That's as much as I can say. That's as much as I'm at liberty to say.
That was the last question I typed up here. Well, that was great. Thank you. Was there anything else you wanted to comment on?
No, it's been a lot of fun. A lot of fun talking, Dwayne, and going through all of this this background for my books. And I would just say, if people are interested in this in science and archaeology and these topics, and want to see some new theories and ideas about them, I would highly recommend that they read these books. They pick them up and read Fragment and Pandemonium and see for themselves what they think.
Yeah, I have read them both, of course. And they are highly, highly enjoyable.
Well, thank you so much. It's been very enjoyable.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed talking about all the stuff with you. Maybe we can do this again sometime. Yeah, that would be a lot of fun.
That would be a lot of fun. And as I'm doing research into what I consider to be the most mysterious group of life on Earth, the fungi, as I get into more of the research and the writing of Symbiont, it'll be interesting to tease some of the research going on there.
I don't know that much about fungi at this point, but cephalopods and monotremes are among my favorites, personally.
Oh, monotremes, absolutely. Wow. Well, what? Yeah. I mean, that's just it. It's so great to find these sort of interstitial species that once again hail from isolated ecosystems like Australia. Yeah, fascinating stuff. I keep discovering almost every week another group of animals that is my, you know, favorite obsession of the day. You know, and there's just so many. It's hard to just rattle them off the top of my head which ones are most interesting to me. But yeah, definitely monotremes and arthropods and Ediacara is something that it's just a mystery that I'm constantly coming back to, because some of the most mysterious fossils are discovered from time to time that are from the Ediacaran period of time before the Cambrian explosion, and the theories keep going back and forth about where they came from. There was some particular region in the middle of the desert of South Africa where they found a canyon and fossils that were embedded in this canyon that seemed to be tiny little toadstools or flower-like fossils. And they're from the Ediacaran era. And they have absolutely no idea what they are. Are they fungus? Are they plants? Are they animals? They have no clue what they were, but there was like a whole sort of forest of them. And that was just recently discovered, and they don't know what the hell they're looking at. So that's the most, you know, that's most intriguing to me, and just probably because it's completely impenetrable at this point in time, but hopefully they'll continue to discover more sites of that most extraordinarily rare epoch of life on Earth.
Oh, wow. So what are some of your favorite cephalopods?
Oh, well, you know, I of course, probably the one that inspired the ghost octopus in Pandemonium the most would be the mimic octopus. And the mimic octopus can mimic at least 15 different species. So it can swim through the water looking just like a lionfish. It can extend its tentacles to look like a sea snake. And it goes on and on. They can actually look like mantis shrimp, but they bury themselves and they squeeze the shape of their head to look just like mantis shrimp. So they disguise themselves in one thing after another. And not only that, but they actually dropped a jar with a handle down into the water where many mimic octopus lived, and they actually started mimicking those jars. So it's not like they just are driven by an instinct. They actually can see something and then duplicate what they're looking at. So that species can even locomote like different species. Only one other animal on planet Earth can do that, and that's us. We can fly, we can scuba dive, we can hang glide, we can bicycle, we can walk on our hands. No other animal does this. They all have a way of locomoting, and that's the way they do it. Antelope don't suddenly start walking on their front paws. They always locomote a certain way. Well, these mimic octopus can literally walk. You know, they can clump their legs together into like four legs, their eight tentacles into four like legs, and then walk along the bottom as though they're quadrupeds. They can swim like fish. They can wriggle like snakes. So they're actually changing the way they locomote in the ocean. And that is by far the most fascinating cephalopod I know of. So, except for the ghost octopus, of course, which I invented. So,
well, as for my favorite, I'm still deciding. I think I might have to go with the mimic octopus, though. That one does sound amazing. Well, I think here would be a really good place to wrap up. So I guess we will wrap up here. Thank you very much, Warren. I think we covered quite a lot of ground.
Okay. Thanks, Dwayne. Cheers.
That is all we have for today. Warren, thanks again for your wonderful, fascinating, and in-depth answers. Very thought-provoking and educational stuff there. And if this does not make anyone want to read your books, I don't know what will. Maybe a movie or something. But that does not teach you all of this extra stuff you covered here, so maybe not. Again, thank you, Warren. Let's hope we have you on again when the next book in the Fragment trilogy, Symbiont, comes out. All right, thank you for listening. Until next episode, stay rational.
If you find value in these podcasts and would like to support us while getting access to bonus content, please consider becoming a patron. You can do so easily by visiting the patrons page on the website, link provided in the show notes. Thanks to all those who are already patrons of the show. Remember to check out the website to read more articles, subscribe if you like our podcast, sign up to our email newsletter, or follow us on Facebook, Twitter to get the updates. You can also check out our Metaphysics of Physics merchandise if you wish. All profits from these go back into the show. And as always, you are welcome to send in questions to questions@metaphysicsofphysics.com. Or you can also contact us via contact@metaphysicsofphysics.com. If you want to talk to us about physics, philosophy of science, any of the other sciences, or anything relevant at all, we are always looking for more people to interview or appear on the show. Please tune in for the next episode and start thinking of some questions. Until then, stay rational.